So thank you, and thanks for the opportunity to give a talk. So I'm going to start with an introduction, which you may have all heard. I don't know who's, I mean, Michael Ovitz has spoken, some of this stuff was done with Michael, so you may have heard this all before initially, but I'll go through it anyway, just in case someone hasn't. And then what we've been working on more recently is sort of the consequences of noise. So I'm going to look at one possible consequence of intrinsic noise for how networks, when these very simple networks are set up, and another possibility for how networks deal with extrinsic noise. And if this people want to, we've also come up with a method where we can kind of exploit noise ourselves in cells to try and figure out the numbers of molecules that are present in fluorescence measurements. Okay, so as you probably all know, chemical reactions are stochastic, and they're stochastic for two reasons. If two molecules are going to interact, they have to find each other in space, which is happens by diffusion. And then once they're there, they have to have enough energy to cross the activation barrier. And again, how much energy they have when they arrive will depend on thermal fluctuations or upon collisions with other molecules. So this is a very simple model of gene expression where I make protein P with some constant probability K, and it degrades with some probability D. And then here's two simulations just to show how much variation you can get with the same parameters. Okay, so it doesn't work very well, but you get the idea. And at times, the red curve this is the average, and you can see that sometimes you will be this blue curve follows average quite well, except for here, and the red curve at times will dip below the average significantly. And this is what we've been exploring: is what are the consequences of these fluctuations for how cells process information? Again, as you just numbers of molecules. So it's 40. You know, I set. So it's, here I have low numbers of molecules. The average is about 40. Okay, and then when I redo the same simulation, I just change the parameters, so I have the higher average, then you can see the fluctuations disappear. And why is this? This is because stochastic effects, they don't stop a reaction from happening. They change the timing at which the reaction occurs. And every time a reaction occurs, the number of molecules change by one or by two. And so it's only really when the mean number of molecules are small that those changes of one and two become significant. So it's only when you have small molecules, smaller numbers here, that you can see the fluctuations by I are much larger. There's that very simple thing I just showed you before, just three runs of it. Okay, and then a measure of noise is the standard deviation of the mean, which is this typical size of these fluctuations away from the mean level. Probably it was less. Okay, so why do we care? So there's two different avenues. There's two different ways of thinking about it. Engineers or physicists often, which is what I mainly worked on, is the idea that noise must be bad. That here's a cells that want to process information, and yet the components of that networks that do the information processing themselves change in ways you can't predict. So somehow this must degrade the information processing capabilities of the cells. And a nice example is the one from Stan Leibler, Michael Ovitz's work, where this is Michael's procrastinator thing, and he shows that when he simulates it stochastically, what was a nice, smooth, deterministic oscillation gets degraded because of these of the fluctuations. So here, it's the idea that noise is potentially bad. And so, yep. So go some more slowly. Yeah. All right. So I'll slow down. Yeah. Sorry. So this is I stole from his Nature paper, and these are just his. He has this replicator system where he has three genes, each of which represses the other. And because there's three of them, you get the overall effect is negative feedback, and the system oscillates. So when he simulates it deterministically, he gets these nice oscillations of the three proteins, with the same parameters. When he uses a Gillespie algorithm, which should have as its mean, should look like this. When you you simulate it then you have this, you see this degradation in the oscillations. So certainly the amplitude is changing, and this here is the autocorrelation function, which should be like this, but it gets degraded with some timescale because of the fluctuations. So a naive model of an oscillator won't work potentially in the stochastic environment of the cell. So if the cell wants to build an oscillator, it's likely to evolve some more complex mechanisms to try and control for these noise effects. So that's the one side is that noise is bad, and somehow the cells have to have evolved mechanisms to cope with it, so they can do clean information processing. The other avenue that a lot of biologists favor is that noise is a good thing. It's something that the cells can exploit to try and explore more of phenotype space with the same genotype. A nice example is Salmonella. So this is the Salmonella bug that affects us with food poisoning. And typically it has some flagella, and typically the flagella is made up of this H2 protein. And this is the protein that our immune system tends to recognize. What the flagella are able to do is they can invert their promoter, so they can actually flip the DNA in their promoter. And by doing that, they switch off the production of this H2 protein and switch on the production of another protein, H1, which codes for the flagella as well, but now is not recognized by the immune system. So what's believed to happen is that by chance, taking advantage of these stochastic fluctuations, some cells in a population that infects us will flip and will be in this state. So they'll survive the first wave of attack of our immune system. So eventually, hopefully, they will be recognized and killed. But the advantage to the bug is that because you survive longer in the organism, there's a greater chance of you infecting more people. Because then our immune system would evolve to recognize H1. But, I mean, the idea is that to try and defeat the immune system, it's, if you do something randomly, the immune system can't guess. I used to know, but I can't remember. Yeah. This is sort of fairly standard, so this is just from a like it's easy to look up. I don't know. We need the evolution person here, but I guess if you have a polymorphic population, then there'll always be a fraction of cells which containing this here, so the immune system eventually will get used to it. So I guess sometimes it's there and sometimes it isn't, and that potentially makes it more difficult for the immune system. Perhaps you can make an argument. I don't know a lot about it. I just but that's possible. There's other examples which are maybe better ones that Adam Arkin has proposed, where bacteria will do things again in ways that, by doing it randomly, it's harder for the immune system to guess what they're going to do. But the point of the slide is just to show you that maybe cells can use this as well to their advantage. So first, sorry. So is this really significant in vivo? So this is the stuff, the work that Mike Olivitz and I did. 2002, and so just to remind you, in bacteria, everything happens all at once. So the DNA is transcribed into RNA and then translated into proteins as soon as some mRNA appears in the cell. So everything's optimized for speed. So to give an idea of what's going on, this is another Gillespie simulation of stochastic of a constitutive model of gene expression, which is again, unregulated. So here's protein number as a function of time. And you can see that protein gradually increases, then the cell divides, it drops by a factor of roughly 2, increases, et cetera, and divides. The red dots are where the gene encoding the protein gets replicated. Now, I just made that to be uniform. There's no reason why it should be uniform. But you can see that there's a slight change in kink in the curve here, where when you have two copies of the gene, because once you have two copies of the gene, you're replicating, you're synthesizing twice as much mRNA, and so you should expect the protein to go up. If I look at the concentration, the cell volume is also doubling, so cell volume is going from V to 2V. So if the number of molecules go from 4,000 to 8,000, we expect the concentration to be roughly uniform. But because of these replication events, in fact, you get a curve that oscillates, but you see many more fluctuations. And we can measure the noise in that, and it's about 7%. And then finally, this is the mRNA. The mRNA has a much smaller half-life, so it's minutes, compared to the protein, which is basically set by the cell division cycle, which is about an hour. So the mRNA, it's much more noisy, but it tracks very well the protein, the gene copy number. So here I have one copy of the gene. mRNA is about 5. The gene gets replicated. I have two copies. It jumps up to 10. The cell divides. It drops to 5. Jumps up to 10. 5, 10, etc. And in fact, because it's more noisy, but because of this difference in timescales, you can do several mathematical tricks to try and solve these systems, where you set this essentially to steady state and allows you to go ahead and calculate the other things. So that's kind of what we expect to be happening for a constitutive gene. So how would we measure it? Well, really, I guess we'd like to try and characterize a promoter. So the naive idea was to take E. coli and integrate green fluorescent protein into the chromosome of E. coli and put our promoter of interest here. Then we could look at a population of cells which would each express different amounts of the fluorescent protein. And by looking at calculating the fluorescence in each cell and calculating the standard deviation and the mean, I could divide those two and I could calculate the noise from a particular gene. Now the problem is that, as you probably all know, that the problem is that this cell here is maybe at a very different stage in the cell cycle from the other cells, and maybe that's the reason why it's brighter. It's not due to stochastic fluctuations, because the cell is simply different from the other ones. Or possibly the environment over here is slightly different from the environment here, and again, that's the reason why we're seeing some variation. Or one cell has more RNA polymerase than the other cell, more ribosomes, less ribosomes, etc. So we had to try and control for that, and the trick that was we did was to cut up two colors, and we put the promoter here and the promoter here in the same ribosome binding sites. And then by looking at the difference between the two colors, we can tease out these effects. So the idea is, let's say if I here's my bacteria expressing my two reporters. This again is the same promoter here and here. Now, because of cell cycle effects, because of changes in the environment, the concentrations of those two proteins are going to fluctuate. However, if there's no intrinsic noise, no noise in this process of gene expression, then even though they'll fluctuate, the red and the yellow, red and the green should be the same in each cell. So if I look at one cell over time, it should do something like this. They'll be fluctuating, but red and green will match each other. So if I take a snapshot of a group of cells, they should appear roughly yellow. Yeah. They're not on plasmids, they're on the chromosome. Yeah, that's potentially a problem, but I can come back to it. I mean, it's not a problem for our experiments, but it might have been, but it wasn't. So that we put them... Right, so, sure. Yeah, we are assuming that. And the other thing that we did was we put them equidistant from the origin of replication, so they're both on one on each arm, if you like, of a circular chromosome. So the idea that they get replicated at the same time. So that could potentially be a problem, but if we do statistical tests for our distributions, that's not a problem. So we were lucky. Yeah. So then the idea would be that if there is noise here, then sometimes in one cell, sometimes it will produce more red than green, and sometimes more green than red. So if I look at a snapshot, then I should see this color appearing. And the amount of color that we see is a measure of how noisy this particular promoter that we put here is. And in fact, we can do a little bit better. We can distinguish between sort of this intrinsic and extrinsic effect, where extrinsic variables are ones that affect each of our two copies in the same way. So the number of polymerases and the number of ribosomes. The number of ribosomes will affect translation from both the two copies in the same way. So they're extrinsic variables. The cellular environment is an extrinsic variable. It'll affect gene expression from here and here in the same way, et cetera. And then intrinsic variables are ones that are different from each gene. So the number of transcribing RNA polymerases or the number of translating ribosomes will be different between the two copies. So fluctuations in these variables, in the values of these variables, give an intrinsic noise. And fluctuations in these variables give an extrinsic noise. And when we do modeling, then we always just model intrinsic noise effects. So these are some of Michael's Elovitz's pictures. So here's the bacteria. When they're expressing our reporters, so if we look in one, if we look at the CFP, one of the reporters, it'll look better like that. The YFP is the other one, and if I combine them together, you can see this sort of color appearing, kind of. So here, you know, here's a cell that's expressing at this moment in time equal amounts of red and green. Here's a red one, here's a green one, et cetera. And so to characterize the noise for this particular promoter, all we did was in some sense, measure the color distribution here. And also, is that a slider? Yeah, also we can measure the intrinsic noise by looking at the color difference. And by looking just at one of the colors in isolation, we can measure the total noise. And then the difference between those two, in some sense, is the extrinsic noise. So we can characterize all three different types of noise. As that predicted from our models, if you decrease the expression from your promoter, so if you have a weaker promoter, we expect things to be more noisy, and this is the experiment just showing that that happens. So that the intensity drops, and you see the intrinsic noise goes up, and the extrinsic noise also changes, and that changes because of the way that we did this change in expression. Okay, so I hope the purpose of these was just to give you some intuition for what I mean by intrinsic and extrinsic noise, and then also just to show that these are really happening inside cells, and so potentially something cells have to worry about. So what we were thinking about initially was, well, what are the consequences of intrinsic noise? And nearly all models that people do, at least for bacteria, the noise looks something like this. So first of all, there's this term, which is sort of a general Poisson process. Okay, one over the number of proteins. If you make something at a constant rate k and it let it degrade at some rate d, then you get a noise like this, one over the number of proteins, which is the standard thing that many you know, the one over the square root of n. What's different about this Poisson process is that the proteins are actually being made from mRNA, and mRNA itself is fluctuating. So it's sort of a Poisson process from a fluctuating source, and that gives a correction term, which is the fluctuations in that source, the mRNA noise, but then it's averaged over the protein lifetime. So, it turns out that this term is the dominant term for typical values in E. coli, we think. But isn't the sum of a Poisson process a Poisson process? That's true. Yeah. Well, here it's very. This is the simplest thing you can come up with that looks vaguely realistic. And so translation is a first order process, and transcription is a first order process. If you do more complicated things and make translation and transcription, you include the ribosome binding and RNA polymerase binding. This thing looks roughly the same. This factor gets changed a little bit, but roughly it's the same. I did that. You know, I've done that calculation. Yeah, but you still, I would still expect you have some term going like this, maybe with something in front of it, and another term like this. And what's important is this term is bigger than that term, but for my purposes. Okay. And this is a nice intuitive way of thinking about it. It's very useful for understanding experiments rather than bringing in many extra processes with many more parameters which you don't know. Yeah. It's actually slightly because the protein decay rate is much smaller than the mRNA decay rate. Somewhere there's a sum of the two. I can't remember. The intuition is that the longer lived the protein is, the more mRNA fluctuations it can average over. So the less important this term is. This term becomes. Well, again, this is within the simple model. It assumes that both are first order processes, so in that sense, yes, they're incorrect. Well, that's in there. So that type of effect would be in there. Again, as I said, it's a simple model. But I think it's intuitively it sort of makes sense. You have the Poisson term, and it's corrected by a, because you're making proteins from a noisy source, and in fact this term tends to be the larger one. And that's, it was that observation that that we played with a little bit. So if most of the noise is coming from transcription, then what can we think of ways to try and attenuate these intrinsic fluctuations? First of all, this is just the definition, it's not too important, of intrinsic noise. So it's sort of, here's the two different proteins, the CFP and the YFP, and it's just their average variation, normalized by some scale. But the idea, the first obvious idea is that, well, if most of the noise is coming from mRNA, one way to try and attenuate noise between two proteins is just to put them on the same mRNA. Okay, with the idea that if I have an operon-like structure and both proteins are coded by the same mRNA, then I've kind of lost the noise source, and overall the noise in the system will have reduced, and there'll be more correlation between these two proteins. You process them out, you mean? So there's, well, I think maybe you're asking about different ribosome binding sites and things like that. So yeah. So I play with that a little bit. So as Nicholas was saying, I mean, you have to worry a little bit about what's now you have two things on the mRNA. So how are they translated? And I thought you could have a case where there's just one ribosome binding site. I mean, there are some old papers saying that's true, where the ribosome will bind at one end of the mRNA and just translate one protein, and will somehow continue on through and translate the next one. But I gave a talk in Heidelberg, and everyone told me that was nonsense. But even if you have two ribosome binding sites where they're now independent, the fact you have two independent ribosome binding sites, you can imagine will make the noise increase compared to the one ribosome binding site case, which is what happens. I should explain what's going on here. So here's the noise, the mean protein number, the constitutive case where they're both just produced from constitutively from two different genes. The noise is here. You can see that if by putting them both on the mRNA, I have one ribosome binding site, the noise drops significantly. If I have two ribosome binding sites, it tends to be smaller. Something funny happens here. This is, again, what Nicholas was alluding to. And this is, now I have two things on my mRNA, I have to decide how the mRNA is going to decay. And the naive way I did it is that I assume that RNA A's E, binds to the front of the mRNA and then chomps along. So if you're the second gene, you tend to be expressed more for a given mRNA because it takes the first gene has to be degraded before you start to get degraded. And I think that's what causes this sort of rise in the noise here, because now your two distributions aren't very symmetric anymore. But in general, the idea is that you can see that, certainly in a region where the number of the proteins are small, that the noise is reduced by having them on the same mRNA. And some people have done experiments to show this. This is, in some ways, a nice test to show whether transcription and translation is important in noise. So if translation is important, this effect shouldn't take place. But if transcription is contributing to the noise, then this effect should. And Viktor Sorgic in Heidelberg has done experiments like this, and indeed shows that the noise reduces when he puts these two things on an operon. And there's another group that's also done that. Even better, they even cite my paper. The other obvious way to try and reduce noise is negative feedback, and obviously people have thought about this a long time, and usually what people consider is transcriptional feedback, where the protein here comes back and binds to the promoter and reduces transcription. So if you have a high amount of protein, higher than average, the promoter site will be blocked by the promoting and levels will fall, and if you have less, then the promoter site will tend to be free and levels will rise. The other way, though, intuitively, a better way to do it would be to feedback on the level of the mRNA. If most of the noise is coming from the mRNA fluctuations, if you feed back at mRNA, you're sort of feeding back more directly on the source of your noise, and you should do better in terms of reducing fluctuations. This is just to show. So ignore this stuff for a minute. This is just showing what I mean by transcription and translation. So protein A can come back and bind here for transcriptional feedback, or it can come and bind to the ribosome binding site for translational feedback. And in fact, there's actually three different mechanisms that people propose for how this works. Either protein binds like this. By doing so, it stops our ribosomes from binding, so translation drops. But also, it often encourages degradation. So somehow having a protein here stabilizes the direction between RNAs and the mRNA, and degradation is increased. So there are other translational repressors that don't do that. There's even other ones that will only bind when a ribosome is here. So they bind to a ribosome and stick it there, preventing translation. But I'll consider the case where the protein binds, stops ribosomes from binding, and at the same time decreases the stability of the mRNA by encouraging RNase to bind to it. This is just to show that indeed that is a much better way to reduce noise. So here again, protein number, intrinsic noise. Here's the constitutive case, where it's of a protein being expressed. Here's transcriptional feedback. And funnily, and oddly, transcriptional feedback actually increases the noise in some regions of protein number, but then decreases it over here. My simulations sort of stop, which is why it bunches up here. And these are the translational noise with those three different mechanisms, and all of them reduce the noise significantly. And the reason why the transcriptional feedback increases the noise is that for each of these points, I chose a random protein degradation rate. So I wanted to keep the feedback strength the same, and that doesn't depend on the protein degradation rate. So for a fixed protein number, the feedback strength is the same for each of these different things. But by doing that, I think this is a genuine effect. It's very hard to add transcriptional feedback to the system and not have the noise go up, because by doing that, you also decrease the numbers of molecules, you play with the numbers of mRNA, etc. But that doesn't happen with translational feedback. You can have exactly the same steady state values, and the noise reduces. I looked at that a little bit, but it was I didn't really conclude anything that I thought I should say. I mean, that's another argument for why translational feedback is maybe better, because you're feeding back more quickly on the source of the noise, so there's less delay. With transcriptional feedback, you have to go to the thing in it, right? So that's true. So again, can we see places in biology where this might happen? So a place where yep. Oops, sorry. That's true. So here I've assumed so protein is much longer lived than mRNA.
So how does it
look
like?
I haven't played with that very much. I don't have any guess. so again, where might this be happening in cells? Well, a place where you really don't want to have intrinsic noise is probably is an assembly of macromolecular protein complexes. Here's a case where, let's say, particularly ribosomes, where the cell's making lots and lots of ribosomes. If there's poor coordination between all the different components of the complex, you can have this scenario where you have some complexes formed, but you produce much more blue protein than you need, and so you have all this excess protein left over, which is potentially very wasteful, particularly if you're making a lot of these complexes. The other scenario is where you have one of these things missing because of a fluctuation, and then you have all these semi-formed complexes which aren't able to function. So it makes sense that intuitively this is an area where the cell has probably invested some effort to try and ensure that the numbers of proteins it makes that make up the complex are coordinated with each other. So what I wanted to do was to compare those two different feedback mechanisms and ask how well they can solve this coordination problem. So to do that, it's a little bit complicated. To do that, I'm going to form a trimeric complex. So I'm going to have some protein C, which is a control protein, and then A and B are going to bind to it. And by doing so, they form this trimer. And they can do it either way. So if A can bind to C, and then B can bind to that complex to form the trimer, or first of all, B can bind to C, and then A can bind to that complex to form the trimer. And to mimic different metabolic demands for this complex, I'm going to change this control protein C. Okay, this protein is constitutively expressed, and I'm just going to change the rate at which it's constitutively expressed. So sometimes there'll be lots of it in the cell, sometimes very little of it in the cell. And then an efficient means for making complexes should be able to tune the amount of A and B that the cell produces to match the level of C present there. Okay, so the thing that does that well has an intrinsic noise sort of reducing mechanism. And one way to quantify that is this expression, which is the wastage rate. So basically, how much stuff is left over after you've made the complexes. So if I have 1A and 1B, and I make one complex, then this thing is zero. So 1A plus 1B and 1C come together, then this is zero. Okay, so it's just a measure of how much the cell overshoots or undershoots what it wants, given the amount of C that it requires at that present time. Okay, is that okay? Did I explain that all right? Okay, and then the two, so what, what systems am I going to compare? Well, the first system is just constitutive expression. So A and B is going to be made at some fixed rate. It's not going to do very well. The other way is the transcriptional feedback. So I'm going to put genes A and B on one operon, because I know that increases their correlation. And I'm going to, this is the same as before, I have transcriptional feedback where A will come back here, or I have translational feedback where this will happen. And then here's the results comparing those two things. So again, what's going on? So this is the mean amount of C expressed in a cell. So this will change depending on the demands for the trimer, the complex in the cell. This is this wastage rate, which is sort of the amount of stuff left over once the complexes have been formed. And let's just look at the constitutive case first. Okay, so when constitutive case does very badly when the amount of C is very low, okay, because it's simply producing lots of A and B, and there's lots of wastage because very few of them bind with C to form a complex. As I increase the amount of C in the system, then it gradually does better, and eventually it has some optimum value where the amount of C is being expressed at a rate that matches the amount at which A and B is being expressed. And then it starts to do bad again coming up here. And that's actually because now I have so much C present in the cell. What happens is that all the A gets soaked up into this plate, into this complex, and all the B gets soaked up into this complex, and then I can't form the trimer anymore. So perhaps simply having too much C in the system also causes the wastage rate to start to go up again. These are the two feedback cases. Now, both of them do much better when the level of C is very low. Because when C is very low, the protein A, which is the repressor, can repress through transcriptional or translational feedback. So the level of A and B production is low, and the wastage is small. As the amount of C increases in the system, it binds to A, takes A away, then the repressor is dropping, and transcriptional translational feedback can both increase. And the thing, you can see this level stays almost constant, and then eventually it starts to increase a little, the wastage rate starts to increase, and eventually it drops back onto the constitutive case because A, the repressor A is always in the complex, and the two genes are just always on. There's a simulation. And you can see that the translational feedback does better. So this is the mean rate, and the mean rate is lower. Not terribly significantly, but lower. Well, this is a log scale, so it's actually not too bad. So I should plug it in, and it wants to keep stop doing that. No, I haven't tried, actually. Yes, I do. Yeah. I haven't played with that. I mean, this is all steady state, so in the sense that the time is no relevant time scale.
Your mechanism by which the story is speak of the operand is relied on the fact.
Oh yeah, yes, so that's true. I didn't actually expect to happen. I just put the scheme together and then I saw it occurring. Yeah. Yeah. So that would go away if I fixed that. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so if I'm an E. coli and I'm making ribosomes, and I make, let's say 1,000 proteins, only 500 of them can be incorporated into ribosomes, then an E. coli that doesn't do that presumably is better than me. Yeah. That's true, but if I wasn't doing that, I would grow faster than the person who was doing it, the bacteria that was doing that.
Perhaps. The proteins that are not sequestered into one fold and fold round can be then sequestered in another, because then the fluctuation of now kind of fluid is itself, but then in the next round randomly blue will be a red cardio, but red will be a more red. So in several rounds it will be this fluctuation will be able.
Well, also the cell is dividing, right? So then you have another binomial distribution where you're partitioning them. So you're not necessarily, that's going to add extra noise, which might ruin that. But also, I mean, you want to do it quickly. I mean, if you're a population of bacteria and you're relying on, okay, in three generations' time, those proteins that I made will be useful, something that's coordinated itself better will have dominated the population by the time you're supposed to be waiting there. I mean, it's growing fast is kind of what bacteria are doing, and I don't think it makes necessarily makes sense to wait to anticipate that you can wait in several generations to take advantage of something you've made.
No, I'm not talking about generations.
Well, we're talking 40-minute division times. I guess that's true. So, I mean, the time taken to make a protein is maybe 3 to 5 minutes, and the bacteria can grow at 20 minutes. So you've still got just four, you've got four, maybe, you know, it's not, that's not a big difference in time scales.
Right, and it's not that kind of,
but there's no disadvantage to doing this. Obviously. I mean, if you do this, this is probably is only going to be a good thing. And in fact, they do this, and this is why I'm talking about it. So this was just this mean wastage rate, and we can also look at the fluctuations around the mean. And again, the translational feedback does better than the transcriptional feedback. So you make it a mean rate, and you stay there. You don't suddenly make more or make less, causing degradation. So again, this is. I've alluded to ribosomes, and indeed this is what some proteins evolved from ribosomes do. So there's this L1 protein, which is a ribosomal protein. It binds to our RNA to form the ribosome, but it also binds to its own mRNA and stops translation and increases degradation. This is not uncommon in translational repressors, that they have two targets, one their function, and the second one their own mRNA, so that the level is tuned when demand is there. And doing it with translational feedback is much better, or is better than doing it with transcriptional feedback. Of course, the problem with translational feedback is you're spending more energy in the sense that you're making mRNA, whereas transcriptional feedback, you don't do that. So there's kind of an energy cost. So if the cell does choose to use translational feedback, it's perhaps, and if we agree that feedback is to try and reduce fluctuations, then those proteins involving translational feedback may be more important in the cellular network in some sense, where you really don't want them to fluctuate very much. And the few examples I find, that's true. I mean, so there's HFQ, which controls I think it's RPO sigma factor, is one which translation feedbacks on itself. And it's shown that if you mess that up, the cells aren't very happy doing that. Other ones are the RNA ases, and they're a little bit more complicated. But again, there's several RNA ases which translationally feedback on themselves, but they could feedback on each other, or they could transcriptionally feedback. And again, if you overexpress those RNA ases, the cells are in trouble. So it's maybe an indication, if you see that translational feedback has evolved, that perhaps this protein is a more important protein. It's important in some way in the network, because the cell is trying to keep those fluctuations low.
What about codon
biases? I don't know. I haven't thought about that. Yeah, I mean, people have done that to try and look at the effects of translation on noise by playing with codons. But they unfortunately, they, well, from my point of view, they use this Fano factor with the variance divided by the mean, and it's very hard for me to interpret what that means. Certainly, when people have done experiments where they put things on operons, then the noise is reduced. So maybe both, and also it presumably changes from gene to gene. So some genes translation is important, others transcription is important. Yeah. But the interesting thing is your small RNAs.
Right.
Yeah, so that's what I want to think. Yeah, I don't know. I thought I'd talk to you about it. No, but I think it's kind of intriguing that maybe there is something that's worth. Yeah, I don't know much about them, so I thought, yeah. Okay, so I think that's it for intrinsic noise. So the next thing that we think about more recently is extrinsic noise. And what does extrinsic noise do? Well, the example we were thinking of was the problem for a cell is that all the cell's kind of information processing machinery is inside the cell. But really, it wants to make decisions about what's happening outside the cell. And because of extrinsic noise, what it sees, interested in information, is not necessarily a good copy of what's happening outside. So this is the example we consider. Here, We imagine that the extracellular environment just exists in two states. It's either in a high, these green things are sugar, so a high sugar state, or in a low sugar state. This is supposed to be the cell's decision-making machinery. And then extrinsic noise causes some concentration of intracellular sugar. And because of fluctuations, this intracellular sugar may be a very poor reading for extracellular sugar. So here, here's exactly the same. So here the cell, given this information, it's very hard for the cell to, intracellularly, it's very hard for the cell to know whether there's lots of sugar outside or very little sugar outside. And this is important because there's experiments that show that if you tend to produce, for example, the lac operon, when you shouldn't be, then that's bad, and there is a metabolic cost for doing that. And this is a very simple example, but you can imagine this thing happens all the time. For example, a muscle cell receives some hormone which tells it whether to contract or not. Is intracellular hormone a good copy of, or a good indicator of extracellular hormone? So how does the cell solve these kind of noisy problems? And again, decided to talk together. This problem arises because of extrinsic noise, where fluctuations in the environment and how this environmental signal is taken inside the cell disrupt the information.
Yeah. You hear that whatever is outside of the cell basically
is designed by
we don't.
Yeah, yeah. We don't worry. There's some mechanism that takes it in. That mechanism will probably be noisy in some way or other.
But the mechanism itself will be coupled.
Yeah, it could be. But there's things like vitamin D which diffuses into cells. I mean, there's lots of cases. The purpose is just sort of to pose the problem and to think about what the cell might do. So this is okay. So here's a case where there's not really a difficulty. So these are the two intracellular distributions which reflect the two extracellular states. This is the low sugar state and this is the high sugar state. And there's very little overlap between these two distributions. So if I look at intracellular sugar and it's over here, then I'm pretty sure it comes from the high outside the cell is the high state. And if it's over here, I know outside the cell is the low state. So there's not really a problem. With extrinsic noise, though, these two distributions can start to overlap. And that's when things get a little bit more tricky. So in this region, if I see sugar over here, then I'm fine. I know it's probably from the high state. And sugar over here, I know it's from the low state. But if the sugar in the cell is somewhere in here, then it's not entirely obvious what's the most likely state of the environment. So if we were confronted with this problem, we were thinking about it, well, how would we solve it? And the very standard way is using Bayesian analysis. But it sort of assumes, so here's the environment, and that's causing intracellular sugar. And there's theorems which sort of say this is the optimum way of solving these kinds of problems. And so the probability of being in a high state outside, given what you see inside, is related to the distribution of sugar in the high state. I guess I should say, and also, the Bayesian kind of philosophy is that before you even see any sugar, you have some idea of what's going on, what sort of is going on in your environment. So you have some prior probability for the high state. And this could be very simple. Your knowledge could just be that you expect the environment to be in two states. So a high state or a low state, and the probability of those two states are equally likely. In which case, this is just a half, and we can not worry about it too much. And the idea is then, once you see intracellular sugar, this prior guess, your initial guess, gets updated by the sugar that you see, and you get your final guess, which is this posterior probability. So I'll illustrate it a bit better in a minute. For those more mathematically inclined, you can sort of see, because we can, this factorizes into that. The idea is that if the sugar you see is very likely to come from a high state distribution, then this number is going to be very large, this number will be large, and this number will be small, and so this thing will be close to 1. And similarly, if it came, it's very likely to come from the low distribution, then this is small, and this is large, and this thing is close to 0. So just to show you what that looks like. So this may be a bit boring for people, but just to give you an idea. So the prior probability is, all I know, the environment is in two possible states. I can assume they're equally likely. Then I take a measurement of intracellular sugar. It's over here. I'm fairly certain it's in the coming from the red distribution, which corresponds to the low state. So my posterior probability of the low state increases. Just to reiterate, so if I get a measurement that's here, then the posterior probability is more likely to come from the blue distribution than the red distribution. So this increases proportionally. And if I get something in the middle, then I don't learn anything. So if you do that systematically, you get a this posterior probability curve. So this, just to reiterate, so this says that if I see this amount of sugar intracellularly given these two distributions, then I'm very likely to be in the high extracellular sugar state. And if I see a probability here, then I have a certain, I have this a probability of about a quarter. If I see sugar at this level, a probability of about a quarter of being in a high extracellular state. And what's interesting is this curve is often a sigmoidal curve. And many gene networks and many signal transduction networks produce sigmoidal curves. Their output is of a sigmoidal form. With what, sorry? Well, I'll show you. I mean, it fits pretty well. Yeah. Yeah, but there's lots of other cases where you can't, at least in our models, that you can't see the difference. Yeah. Any question? Okay, but the idea is, well, you know, this is the type of problem that cells probably have to solve. The solution, the ideal solution in some sense, is a sigmoidal curve. And many cellular networks produce sigmoidal-like curves. Maybe not exactly the same, but sigmoidal-like curves. And just to just show you, so this curve will change depending on the overlap between these two distributions. If the distributions are far apart, you get a steeper curve. If you overlap more, you get a more gradual curve. And so what we wanted to do is we wanted to ask, can we build on the computer a very simple genetic network that's able to produce output that matches this curve given the amount of sugar it's seeing inside the cell? So in some sense, then that network is solving this inference problem, and it's sort of is finding the optimal solution to getting around the extrinsic noise. So though, of course, we know for a real cell, we don't know what problem it's trying to solve. So we generated 50 different log normal distributions, calculated that posterior probability curves, and generated this collection of curves. And then we're going to take our networks and fit them to all of them, and ask, with the network which is best able to fit all these curves, in some sense, is the network that's best able to solve inference problems. Doesn't have to be. We did Poisson, we did Gaussian, doesn't make a difference. Okay, so how do I define sugar? How do I define my network? So the network input is going to be the sugar, the intracellular sugar. The network output, we decided to use the promoter efficacy. But so what I mean there is the amount of time that the promoter is able to initiate transcription. So when basically the thing is primed to go. So if it's negatively controlled, that means the promoter is free of repressor. And if it's positively controlled, that means the promoter is bound by an activator. So we're just going to consider a one gene network. And we're going to let the network be controlled by a transcription factor. And that's going to be an allosteric transcription factor. So this is the mono-Wyman-Change model. The transcription factor exists in two states. One state where it's able to bind DNA with a circle here. Another state when it can't bind DNA with DNA, it's a triangle. If it's a repressor, then the presence of sugar should lift it off DNA. So if I make the binding affinity to sugar on this side of the branch stronger than the branch on this side, then when sugar is present, it'll bind to here rather than to here. This will move into here. This equilibrium here is then broken because I pulled away a triangular molecule. It will reestablish by converting more of these circles into triangles. And the more and more sugar I have, the more it gets funneled down here, and the more of these move down here. So in the presence of sugar causes a sigmoidal transition where the whole thing flips into the non-DNA binding form. And how sigmoidal it is depends on the parameters, but also depends on the number of sugars that are allowed to bind. So we allow, in our models, we consider 1, 2, and 4. What's also interesting is that this is really an ideal kind of detector for solving these two-state problems. Because here's a protein that's moving around in the cytosol, flipping between two states. One state corresponds to, if it's a repressor, one state corresponds to DNA binding, which means no sugar is there. If sugar is present, it tends to be more in the DNA binding form. So we were kind of visualizing the sea of repressors in the cytosol as each as individual detectors, which, depending on which allosteric state they were in, they gave a readout for how much sugar was present inside the cell. And then what the promoter does is the promoter kind of makes a reading of the levels of these different proteins. proteins. So we consider three different types of promoter, to be simple. One with just one binding site, one with two binding sites. Both these binding sites are active in the sense that if a repressor binds to either of them, then the transcription is shut off, or if an activator binds to either of them, then transcription is enhanced. Or we consider a cooperative case where only one site affects transcription, but the binding of a transcription factor to the other site can stabilize this reaction. And again, we have positive and negative regulation. So if we put those all together, we end up with sort of 18 different networks. So allosteric transcription factor can bind 1, 2, or 4 sugar molecules. We have our three different promoters, and we have positive or negative. So we consider all combinations of those, and then fit them all to that collection of posterior probability curves that I have. And then this is the mean residual for all those fits. So the smaller this thing is, the better the model is at fitting those posterior curves. Least square is fit. So we fit all the parameters. So we have this one, this one, this one, and then these ones here. So we have the what's 6 or 7? I think I can't remember. Depends on the model, but it's somewhere between 4 and 7. Yeah. Now we fit for each curve. We fit the parameters. Then we refit the parameters for the next curve and refit them for the next curve, et cetera, et cetera. And we do that for all the models. The idea is that I don't know what kind of problem the cell is trying to solve. So a network that's easily able to solve many problems is probably the best type of network for solving inference. So we cut out all these fits, and again, this is the results. So this is the residuals. The smaller this is, the better the model is at fitting. Some things that aren't too surprising, you see the more sugar binding sites I have on my transcription factor, the better I fit. Okay, that just means that if I have more sugar binding sites, I'm more sigmoidal, so I'm better able to fit. Some of my posterior probability curves will be very tight, some of them will be very gradual. So if I'm able to tune myself to fit both of those, I'm going to do well. Similarly, we see that the promoter's favorite is the one which has that cooperativity in it as well. What was less obvious is that the negatively controlled networks fit better than the positively controlled networks. No. This is a hypothetical network. Okay, it's not supposed to be the Lac-Operon. It's just a hypothetical transcriptionally controlled network, and we're just asking, can that network solve this? Can we come up with a network that can solve the inference problem, and which networks solve it best? You have a question? No. So we also did the same thing where we used the Bayes information criteria and then this Laplace thing where you kind of look at how steep the minimum is to try and correct for the number of parameters that we have, and it doesn't make a difference. So it is. So what was interesting is that the negative control seems to do better, and if you look at a p-value for this, it's really small. Okay, so this is if I if they both the probability that the negative does better than the positive. So why is that? Because at least for the first sight to us, it seemed like the system was symmetric. And it's coming from this allosteric transcription factor. So let's try and so I can explain this. So let's assume that I'm an activator. If I'm an activator, as I add sugar, I want to start to bind to the DNA. Okay, and then as I bind to the DNA, the output of my operon will increase as the amount of sugar increases. So if I want to bind to the DNA, then I want this side to be the dominant side. So sugar preferentially binds here, which causes everything to flip round into this side of my allosteric transcription factor. But the problem is that down here, I don't want any activators to bind. I want transcription to be off. So that means I want, I require KB to be small. And KB binds KN, so that means KN also must be small. And if I have, the more activators I have in the system, I don't want any to bind here, so it gets harder and harder to stop things from binding. So I have to make KB smaller and smaller. So in some sense, the system is frustrated. And that's not true for repressors. So repressors, it's this side that's supposed to be, that will be favored by sugar binding. Again, I want a repressor to bind here. So I require KB to be large enough that the repressor will bind. But the more repressors I have in the system, the smaller I can make KB. Okay, so in some sense, there's no frustration in that case. And that's why the repressors generally fit better for these types of curves. Late in the day. I can't remember. I read his papers, but I've forgotten what he was saying, but I don't think it's the same. And Uri Alon has another explanation, which is also different. Yeah, so a sigmoidal type curve, yeah. So maybe what you're getting at is I could ask it to fit a curve like this. And that means that when I'm checking the probability of the high state. I could also try and detect the probability of the low state. And if I want to do that, then I should use an activator. So the argument then everything reverses, and an activator is a better way of solving that problem. So we sort of, if this is true, I mean, depending on how important it is to the cells, I mean, if they want to detect a high state, then they should use the repressors. If they want to detect a low state, then they should use activators. There's a lot of argument. There's several arguments like that. I haven't looked. I mean, Uri's had another argument. Yeah. Well, Uri Alon has this evolutionary argument where you want to have the transcription factor bind to the DNA as much as possible to prevent the DNA sites from mutating. And that also explains it. I think it was different because they wouldn't be able to publish it if it was the same. Because Savage reviewed it, I think, or something. Yeah, anyway. Okay, so right, so that's the point. Right, so of course, this was all, I'm almost done. This was just all equilibrium type stuff, right? Equilibrium calculation. So we should be able to take our same network, the one that solved this problem the best, which is the one with four binding sites for the sugar, the cooperative binding, and it was a negatively controlled, and give it some time course of sugar and ask how well does it solve this problem. So to do that, we took our best fit solution. We sample sugar from the blue distribution here, which is this. We then change the environmental state to the high distribution, to the red one, and sample from there, and then we change it back again, the extracellular state, to the low distribution. So we have this kind of time course. And then for each of these sugar values, each of these intracellular sugar values corresponds to some point on this green curve, and so I can sort of measure what the instantaneous posterior probability is for solving this problem. Okay, so most of the time when the sugar is in the low state, the probability of you being in the high state is small. When the sugar is in the high state, the probability is close to 1, etc. And then if our network is really able to solve these problems, it should be able to match this solution as well as it can. And this is the case when we use a negative control. And you can see it's really pretty good. Okay, with our best fit premise, which we've done for equilibrium case. Now we're showing that they also work for a dynamic case. And if I look at the best fit positively controlled network, it doesn't do so well here. And if you do some kind of comparison, this one is almost twice as good. You do a least squares match between here and between here. So this shows that you know, in real time, even this very simple model of inference can seem to work. It's possible for DNA networks to be able to do that. Yeah, we should. No, I should do that. That's a good control. Okay. So then, the other thing that the final part is to say, well, can we sort of see any evidence of this happening in reality? And perhaps you can see something. So there's certainly something funny going on in the lac operon. So Mike Surrett and Uri Alon have measured. In our language, sort of this promoter efficacy is a function of the two inputs to the lac operon, so IPTG, which is lactose for us, and cyclic AMP. And this is supposed to look like that. The accepted wisdom is it's kind of acting a bit like a logic gate. And you should only see expression when you have high cyclic AMP, which means low glucose, and high IPTG or high lactose. And here you shouldn't see anything. But in fact, when they measured the surface, it didn't appear to be like that. You can see there's a second plateau here, and you have this very smooth moving up this way, and doesn't appear to be the logic gate description. So we can say, let's assume that this thing is really trying, it's not solving a logic type problem, but it's trying to solve an inference problem. And so there's two states, which one corresponding to high lactose and low glucose, another one corresponding to low lactose and high glucose. Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's all true. However, the surface still looks different. So if you use the logic gate description to try and explain that data, it's very hard to do that. So what we So, first of all, there's no data for what you want to have, so I can't solve that problem. Secondly, I'm just the point here is just to show that our interpretation can give some insights into these problems that perhaps this logic gate idea, which many people have used before, fail on. And that's all I want to illustrate. And so, again, this surface is it's different from what was expected, but we can, if we make the assumption, as I said, it's only an assumption, that it's solving this two-state problem, we can sort of fit a posterior probability to surface to the data to the output. So this is our fit, which looks fairly good. I mean, we have this thing going on here, which is not exactly there. And then it's even more interesting to ask, well, what kind of inference problem is this the solution of? Yeah. I think they show that you could. Sure. I mean, what they showed is that it's easy to evolve a circuit that does have this function. That does look like this. So the Lac operon, if it wanted to, could do this. So it's not. There's not some stochastic problem. There's nothing. The cell has the potential to form this types of outputs. Because they did some, I may be misremembering, but I'm pretty certain they did some mutational effects with the repressor, and they showed they could generate these types of surfaces. So it doesn't need to have this form. This isn't constrained by stochastic effects or cellular environment or something like that, which maybe I should put up. It should be smooth. So, but this isn't. This doesn't look like smoothing. This part, anyway. Right. I mean, this should look like this. Over here, it should look similar. It should be low. It should be low all around here, and then smooth from there. But that's not, my understanding with the experimental, I mean, evidence was that it wasn't, you know, it's not supposed to have four levels, it's supposed to be, have one, two levels, I mean, this and this. Yeah, sure. It's not going to look like this, but this doesn't. To me, this doesn't look like a smooth version of that. Okay. Shall I move on? Yeah. All we're saying is that this curve is not, to me, is not a smooth version of that. And so we can use this idea. We can ask, can we explain this curve with the idea that the system is solving a two-state problem? Is that at least consistent with what we're seeing? And so to do that, we could write an expression for the posterior probability for the two-state problem, and try and fit it to the surface. And so it fits reasonably well. And what's interesting, unfortunately, it's degenerate, but you can sort of say, well, what type of distributions is E. coli kind of visualizing if it's really doing this to solve this, to give this type of output? So if the two intracellular distributions look like this, then the optimum solution for solving this inference problem would look like this. So using these ideas of inference, you can explain surfaces that are perhaps harder to explain with logic gates. And indeed, we don't always have to be sigmoidal. Okay, so if I can have a long tail here, in which case my posterior probability would do something like that. And indeed, there is data, or you told me in some old papers, which show that this really does happen. And again, this is very hard to explain if you want to using a logic gate type way of doing it, but it's consistent with always within this Bayesian approach. Yeah. Yeah, very simple. Yeah. So this is just the purpose is just to say this is a problem that cells face. Maybe they have found solutions that we have found to the same types of problems. In the sense that, well, not we have found, but in the sense that this Bayesian solution is known to be an optimal solution to these problems. So it's possible that cells, for some networks in cells, have evolved their output to match that Bayesian solution. Now, of course, they may be solving more complicated problems, in which case the solution is different, in which case their output would be different. It's just that. On which receptor, sorry? Yeah, but that's different. That's from dilution. Diluting things out. That's the same as that my constitutive thing, which went back up again. Oh, really? Okay. Yeah, I'd be interested to look at. Yeah. I'd like to see that. Yeah. Anyway, right. So that's finally it. So to conclude. As I said, I was focusing on the consequences of noise for how networks might function. So this idea that negative feedback, that translational feedback is maybe better, and this idea that because the information that cells receive are noisy, they're likely to have evolved some kind of process to try and to extract information reliably from that noise. Now, I try to illustrate it in a very simple case where the two-state environment, we're looking at a genetic network. Oops, I always forget to do that, so I make it automatic. But there's also cases, it's also likely to happen probably in signal transduction, and maybe even more so in signal transduction, because there you want to make a decision relatively quickly. So just to thank people. So the initial stuff was done looking at measuring noise with microelevates and Eric. And then the stuff looking at the inference stuff was done with Eric Libby and Ted Perkins, who are both at McGill. Okay, so thank you.
you're encountering through the form, you're trying to say that the computer would try to find out whether it's the gut or the
region. Or different regions of the gut.
Well, let's say, right, but like you kind of all your inferences based on that. You have two different scenarios, and you have to be able to differentiate between two kind of binary outcomes, whether, you know, the measure of concentration of people comes from this distribution or from that. But you might argue actually that the bacteria would care less where the sugar is coming from. As long as it is not sugar, you better eat the less.
But that's precisely the problem we're solving. So if you're in a low sugar state, then you don't want to express the operon, because then you're going to, you're wasting, you produce these enzymes which have nothing to digest. But if there's lots of sugar, then you do want to produce it. But the problem is what you see inside is not necessarily a clear measure of what's outside. And so how do you optimize your making that decision? It could be that, or it could also be from the environment is never exactly a fixed sugar level. You know, the environment itself will be fluctuating. It's a combination of both those effects. So the problem with the threshold, though, if you have a fluctuation, you're going to make a decision when you shouldn't be.
Right.
How do you call a fluctuation of the threshold? Oh yeah, sure. In this approach, and this, sorry, okay. So yeah. Yeah. So what you're saying is also what we think is that there's sort of two processes. If you want to make a decision, first of all, you say, okay, well, what's the probable state of my environment? Okay, if it's a 60% chance there's lots of sugar out there, then depending on what sugar it is, I'm going to make a decision about whether I want to use it and where it costs and benefits, and then I cut my sigmoidal curve somewhere. But that's a separate decision that depends really on the type of sugar, what stage in the cell cycle you are, and lots of other things that I don't know what variables take part in that. But still, to make that decision, you still need to know what's the likely state of my environment. And we're just focusing on the first part of that. I haven't done experiments in the LAC system, and we don't have the ideal data set that you mentioned, so we don't know. There are cases, as you also said, where you have these kind of monotonic, you know, these things that go through a maximum, which are very hard to understand from perhaps from a conventional way of doing things. Yeah. We don't have logarithms. I think we just divide the two. So we, Oh, right, because I'm from the one. Yeah. I don't follow. So you're saying if I want to infer the concentration of outside rather than the state outside? No, but I'm just plotting as a function of sugar. No, I'm plotting as a function of sugar. So I'm not plotting as a function of log sugar. No, of course, no, it's not. And in fact, it goes through. It can go through a peak, and that's what's interesting. Yeah, I know, that'd be fantastic. Yeah. Yeah, and see if it changes. Yeah, I mean, that'd be really good. But I mean, that's hard to do. But yeah, I agree. I mean, coming up with a nice experimental test is what's missing, I guess, in some sense.
There's always theories for any sort of generic unimodal
Yeah. So that's true. So I mean, the observation is that many cell systems, cellular systems, produce sigmoidal curves. Perhaps they're doing it for this reason. They could be doing it for other reasons. So again, these more complicated curves that happen are harder to explain with sort of standard arguments where you have some kind of switch and it's a noisy switch or something.